Welcome back, everyone, for the final wrap-up, the finale, Kanban. We're going to be talking about how you take a lot of these ideas and pull it together into one thing. Now, Kanban is something that we could cover kind of at length, and in fact, we spent a full day on it 2 weeks ago, and the link is posted in the Q&A. So if you want to watch 8 hours of Kanban, I highly recommend it. It talks through a lot of the details of how to implement Kanban in your team and organization. And what it doesn't cover is some of the fundamentals that we covered today as to why Kanban works. That's why we're going to have a little bit of a repeat here for the next few minutes where we walk through some of the Kanban concepts and now tie them back to some of the principles that we've looked at.
Right.
Is that a fair statement?
It is a fair statement. So Kanban is always one of those extremely hard to categorize things. It's not a methodology. It's not quite purely a measurement system. It's not, it's kind of in a class all of its own. It's Kanban, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of different from everything else, which I think it's incredibly powerful. What I do want to say is that you don't necessarily have to be doing Kanban to be lean. You could hypothetically accomplish all of this without any sort of Kanban system. That would probably be insanely difficult and revolutionary, and you could publish a book about it and probably make a lot of money. we used the word radically innovative earlier. If you could come up with a way to do this without Kanban, that would be radically innovative, and you could probably go on the speaking circuit and make a lot of money in the agile world.
Yep.
Or you could just use Kanban.
Depends if you're looking to make a splash in the world or you're looking to
deliver value faster.
Deliver value faster, right. Now, that said, you can take parts of these ideas and kind of stitch them into your existing process.
Very true.
Without even visualization. And Kanban, in fact, starts where you are. It's
right.
A great process improvement methodology. But I
just
agree.
Call it a methodology.
You're right. It's a process improvement framework. One of the things, though, that I have to agree with you on is that given the multitude of options out there, Kanban really is the kind of the framework that kind of puts all this together. Other things are lean startup. They kind of grab a lot of these. But when you read the Lean Startup book, it's telling you to put up visualizations and limit work in process. Same thing that Kanban does.
Right.
And you talked a little bit about service orientation and service-oriented architectures, but a services mindset for, rather than box products, services. And that's another lens to look through that also kind of leads back to Kanban in
right.
a lot of ways. All right.
I do want to call out... Kanban is more, in my mind, more conceptually along the lines of something like CMMI, where you're using it to evaluate and improve your existing process. So it is not mutually exclusive to something like Scrum. Kanban fits quite nicely on top of Scrum, managing work and process inside your iterations, and then at the level above teams, managing the work and process across your teams. So Kanban scales quite well up and down every level of your organization. But I do want to call out that we're not saying that Kanban is mutually exclusive to all other agile methodologies that you've ever heard of.
In fact, yeah, you probably are better off laying it on top of some of
right.
those other ideas as well. And you very nicely introduced us to what's
next
coming
week's
next
topic.
Week. Yep, next week's topic, which is taking and making your entire enterprise lean from the bottom to the top or from the top to the bottom, but bringing lean ideas and agile ideas through the entire organization. How to sell it, how to do it. That's next week. So perfect lead-in for that. Thank you. All right. What Kanban is and isn't. It's a way to continuously improve, continuously evaluate existing processes and then evolve them over time to give you a much leaner software development process. But it's as simple as that. It fits very nicely in with lean. It's not a methodology or a cookie cutter solution. I one of my frustrations with Kanban is that I see a lot of people kind of here's Kanban, and here's the process template for Kanban.
And now we're doing Kanban.
Right, and now we're doing Kanban. Now we're done. We've got Kanban implemented. You're never, it's a process improvement framework. And I'm joined in that belief, thankfully, by David Anderson, who kind of founded and really shepherds a lot of that Kanban movement. And he treats it as really a process for taking and improving your practices. At the heart of Kanban, there are two primary principles. We want to pull work and remove bottlenecks. And that's really the core.
Right. We might up level that a level and say we want to focus on being a services oriented, take a services oriented approach to flow through our system. That might be an up level of that, but really that boils down to not pushing work, pulling work, and finding and removing bottlenecks from our flow.
Yep, and success just looks like a steady, predictable flow with short lead times of value through the system. Just steady, fast lead times. It's nirvana in some ways, but the idea is we're marching towards that goal, not necessarily there tomorrow when you implement Kanban.
Right.
Big air quotes there, right? So there's five major steps to Kanban, and some people will tell you three, some people will seven.
I think there's one that's like three and five.
Three and five. Mary Popendick laid out those six principles, right, which I think are fantastic
way to look at it.
I really do as well. But these are the steps to Kanban that were kind of originally used, and I think they're a valuable way to look at it. And the first step is visualize work. Then we go into making policies explicit, limiting the work in process, managing flow, and committing to continual improvement. This is kind of those five steps that we need to go through.
I would like to explicitly call out here, if you do steps one and two, you're not doing Kanban. I want to set that expectation. If you have a Kanban board and it has definitions of done at the bottom, congrats. That's awesome, and it's a great place to be. It's a great place to start. It is absolutely and unequivocally not the end game. The story does not stop there. So many times we go in and we see people who have said, "Hey, look, it's our board, and we're good. We're doing Kanban."
No.
You've got step one and two down. Right?
What are you working on today?
This is an evolution. We're moving forward. We're not. It's not a static, and we're done.
Exactly.
That is totally not what it is.
So in this section, we're going to hit these five steps to Kanban one after the other and kind of lay them out. So very first thing is visualize the flow of action, flow of value. And there's actions and then the principles they tie back to. Andrew, do you want to hit visualizing?
I will. So analyze the process in place. And what we mean by that is what you are doing right now. So the idea is we are going to create a visualization of our current process. And it is the most important part in this step is map the process in use, not the documented process, which is a complicated way of saying don't lie on your Kanban board. When you first make your Kanban board, make it representative of what actually is happening. If you've got 17 columns, you've got 17 columns, deal with it, put it on the wall, understand that that's where you are. Nothing will break Kanban faster than lying on your Kanban board.
Yeah, because then you're not starting where you are. You're not providing anything realistic. Instead, you're putting what you think you should be or where you were in the past or what came off those dusty, you know, documentation things that you have. Yeah. No, start with where you are and visualize all your work. That means put your work, what you're doing, up on the board, even if it falls outside of what you can traditionally consider your work.
Right.
So, for instance, you put up there all of your requirements. That's brain dead simple. The hard part is going through and saying, what have I worked on and do I still have to commit to that, you know, it's just something that the CEO came down and said, would you work on this? And I'd never documented it.
Right.
Time to put it on the wall. It goes on the wall with everything else. The CEO told you to do it. You're probably going to prioritize it right to the top. Maybe. It really depends on the prioritization. But get it on the board.
I'm always surprised to find out just how much managers don't understand the external requests made of their development team that they never know about. Most organizations have back-channel ways to for people to get in touch with developers to get their little thing in the product. If you're not honest about those and you don't make them visible, you can't ever improve your flow. That was too harsh. You're not ever going to be able to improve your flow as much as you should. You have to be able to visualize that stuff and make it transparent. There should never be any work being done by any developer on your team that isn't represented on the board, assuming that your board is a team level board. If your board is the level above team levels, then there shouldn't be any work that's being worked on by a team that isn't on your board.
Yep. And within limits, right? If you've got someone gave you a call and said, hey, can you change the word happy to glad? You're not going to go write something and stick it up on the board.
Unless it's going to take you 3 hours.
Right. And if you have 15 of those requests, you may start to aggregate those and say, a bunch of miscellaneous requests from Bob.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
and tack it up.
Tier one support or whatever.
Exactly. So this abides by some of the key principles that we've talked about and some we haven't talked about, but that are principles. Focusing on flow, managing queues, measuring working software, and continuously delivering value. I think those are kind of those core four principles on this visualize the flow of value.
If you'll notice, those last two principles actually come from the Agile Manifesto.
They do.
Yeah,
because they're...
Just want to call that out. We've got some principles mapped in here from the Agile Manifesto.
And that's a great thing because it comes from both. Now, let's take a look at a board of what we're working on today. Man, this looks like a complicated flow and a complicated board. Andrew, why did we start with such a complicated board?
Because that's where we are.
All right,
that's
fair
what
enough.
We've got. We wanted to be honest. We've got tons of work in process. We've got lots of gates. We've got different queues between different states. We've got a final approval. We've got a production system that stuff seems to sit and wait to be actually deployed for a while. The team probably isn't even really aware of why it's sitting there waiting. They don't know what it's waiting on, but it's waiting on something before it gets into the hand of customer. Notice that we've tried to map out the entire end-to-end flow of value, not just a subset of the flow of value, right? So we're going all the way from origination to in the hands of the customer. We want to map out as far as we can, even if we don't necessarily have control over those, we want to get them on our board and represent them.
Yeah, for instance, final approval, we don't really have control over. We might just be sending out an email to someone and production ready. I mean, that's ITs. I got to tell a story, though. One of our customers, we laid this up on the board. And in fact, you were there. We were both there together. And we had this thing laid up on the board, a team that was going through their process and what they were trying to deliver. And they had part of this, and one of the columns was basically waiting in IT for something to happen, the equivalent of. Well, IT walked by the board, looked at it and said, what? We do a lot of stuff in there. This isn't just it. And the next day, without prompting, all of a sudden, we had another board that was sitting on a free open space next to it, which was the IT's flow, so that they could take items and map them to what was in the column and flow through their own visualization. Yep. What happened was now the developers and IT were kind of understanding what was happening, looking at each other's boards, and they could see, IT could see what was coming through the developer channel, and developers could see, wow, it's really hard to go through IT. There's a lot of different things.
Stuff we never even knew about.
Never even knew about. And frankly, man, we could have so easily just threw in a couple lines of code to solve that problem that you're running into in IT.
To bring it back to the penny game, it's exactly what happened when we adjusted our behavior when we were flowing value through our system. That is what it is, right? It's the exact same thing in software development.
Absolutely. It's crazy. I love it. It's a great example. We're going to go on to the next one, make policies explicit. And here we document that current process and make it part of that big visible display. Keep it short. Definition of done is usually how we do it. Succinct. We're not writing manuals here, but we need to let people know what it takes to make the transition from one column of the board to the other. So this definition of done is different than the Scrum one, which is for the whole team. This is just going from one column to another. What are my expectations? When it went from this column to this column, what was done? What am I able to do?
If teams haven't ever done this before, they tend to get bogged down at this step. And they have endless debates about what the definitions of done are because they don't actually have any yet.
Yep.
If you don't have any yet, don't bog yourself down. write a question mark, move on, do it for a while, and as you move things from that column out of that column, ask yourself, what was done that enabled me to move this from this column to this column, and then write that down. Again, remember, we're not trying to brainstorm on what the beautiful future end state of this is. We want to get down what is our current state. If you don't know the current state, then your current state is a big question mark.
Right? It is so true.
But that's totally acceptable.
It's totally fine.
If that's where you are, write a big question mark, and in a week, have a retrospective and fill it in. But don't debate about what everyone thinks it should be, because that's your future stating. Don't future state on your Kanban board. Always current state on your Kanban board.
Yep. And then as you gradually improve, your improvements get reflected on the Kanban board, right? Yep. Or maybe there's a chicken and egg when you're kind of doing them both, but don't do them both right at the get-go. Yep. Just get what's on there. I love that. Question mark is your current state, if that's the case. That's a great way to put it. There's a couple principles here. Collaboration is a key one here, because right, we're collaborating effectively once we can establish what does it mean for Andrew to give me something and say that he's done with it. And frankly, we may disagree, and then we can work through that and get it back on the board as a definition of done. It establishes trust. Usually, going from one column to another or one handoff, it's not a problem of people underperforming, it's a problem of people overperforming. The business analysts want to put in too much stuff before they give it to the developers. The developers want to polish too much and add too many kind of tweaks and custom features and gold plating before they hand it to the testers. Usually it's not a question of just getting it done, it's a question of over-delivering. This allows you to say, it gives you permission to get it off of your plate without having to overdo it.
Another key aspect of the trust, a client that I'm working with right now, we were flowing some value through our system, and we looked at it, and everybody looks at this last little piece of it, and everybody was going, that's got to be simple. I don't understand why that's taking everybody so long. What's wrong with you people? Why is it taking so long? And that attitude had persisted for months in this organization, right? And it had built up this combative negativity between these two stages of, I don't understand what's taking so long. Well, we finally whiteboarded it out and put it on a board, and all of a sudden, everybody's like, oh, that's what you deal with?
Wow,
that sucks. Like, I can help you with that. I'm a developer. I'm good at making things better. I can help you with that. That switch is just, it's just so powerful. It's so culturally powerful.
Limiting your work in process, getting into a flow model, people start to work together. This is the part that this course, this particular one, we're taking kind of a hard-nosed attitude towards things, and we're laying things out as proofs. Where we can, or assertions backed by arguments, as opposed to, man, this is cool things that happen.
Right.
But yet, wow, those personal interactions which make a place a better place to work are they're spot on. And I, frankly, that's the valuable part. I want to work at a place that I can contribute to my people around me and my team members. I'm
soapboxing again.
So a couple other principles.
If you haven't noticed, this is Steve and I's favorite topic in the whole world. We could talk about this forever.
Oh, absolutely. self-organization and building quality in are another two key principles that we have under making policies explicit. That self-organization piece might be a little, might confuse you a little bit, but when you start thinking that it's the team building the board, they're the ones that define those policies. Now, when we get to the enterprise level, we're going to change that up just a little bit. It won't change the fundamental principles, but we're going to talk about definitions of ready as well as definitions of done between levels of the organization, not just passing horizontally, but passing vertically as well.
Self-organization within a framework.
Bingo. All right, back to the slide again. We've got a fairly complicated one here with some definitions of done across the bottom of where we are today.
Right. So we've went ahead and added a couple lines of definitions of done. Now, obviously, someone's going to read these and go, well, those are terrible definitions of done. But hey, that's where the team was, and that's what we went with. And obviously, I was space limited based on font size and being able to be readable on the PowerPoint slide, right? But you kind of get the idea of the types of things that go into a definition of done. And notice where the definitions of done are located. So they're located directly below the line. So if I look at the InDesign column, the definition of done is located directly below the line between working and done. So what that definition of done is defining is what needs to happen in order for something in that working column to move into the design column. This can be a point of confusion in the beginning. From the working column into the done column. Thank you, Steve. It can be a point of confusion. So remember that your definition of done are attached to lines. What needs to be done in order for something to cross that line?
Yep. All right. Next principle of Kanban. You've got your board up. You're visualizing everything. You've got your policies explicit. Now, let's limit our work in process. And this is what changes a push system into a pull system. Yep. We agree on limits, and we enforce those limits. There might be some times we wobble a bit, but we try to keep in those limits and really try not to get out of them, because that's where we will start to see the real benefits of limiting our work in process and getting faster cycle time.
The work in process limits are absolutely crucial in the beginning to be inviolate. If you start from a position of, maybe this sprint we can go 7 at once, don't do that, please.
Yeah, shoe hurry.
You'll never stop doing that, and it will only get worse. And then 6 months down the road, you don't have work in process limits. Start from a position of they are inviolate. We will absolutely not violate these. 6 months down the road, you might understand how they work well enough inside your own team, and understanding conceptually how they work well enough isn't the same thing as understanding how they work well enough given your team's workload and your team's utilization rates and your team's skill set. You have to understand how they interact with your team before you start moving them around.
Yeah, now that said, you're going to, if you've constrained your WIP limits too much or not enough,
right,
you will make a decision in a retrospective or over a water cooler to adjust those WIP limits, but you're not willy-nilly just
breaking them on the fly.
Let's just take this one because it's important and override our WIP limit. We want to make that decision a decision to change the WIP limit for the entire flow. Nothing wrong with changing the WIP limit, but everything wrong with ignoring the WIP limit, and don't say, oh, now the WIP limit's 6, I'll change it back to 5 once this is off. You're looking at system level things.
Yes. Right. And if you find yourself making your WIP limits higher, you're probably moving in the wrong direction.
Most likely. I do want to stress, this is an interesting interplay between batch sizes, limits, and variability.
Right.
The more variable you're both the sizes of things and the more variable the length of time it takes to deliver things, generally, the higher your WIP limit needs to be to effectively flow work. This is an interesting correlation, but it's an advanced one. I would probably say, to use your example, every time you're in doubt, reduce your WIP limits. You will reduce them, and you won't stop reducing them either. You reduce them, that causes pain and exposes problems. Pretty soon, everything's just clicking along. Everything seems to be fine. Well, that's pretty easy. You just reduce your WIP limit again, just a little bit, and now all of a sudden it's caused more pain. If you're in a development world and you're talking software development, a very common WIP limit is one user story or requirement-y kind of thing per developer. I would suggest you go one per developer minus one as your first WIP limit so that your developers work together or swarm. That causes people to collaborate, and it's just a cultural recommendation at that point.
A very important part of this also is if you're never hitting your WIP limits are wrong.
Yeah.
Because you may as well not have them. Now, there's a caveat to that, which is if you've been doing this for 3 years and stuff flows through your system insanely fast and you're not hitting your whip limits, that's probably okay.
Yeah.
If you've been doing this for 3 weeks and you're never hitting your whip limits, it's probably because your whip limits are too high. You're not using your whip limits what they're intended to do, which is force a pull system and expose bottlenecks.
Yeah, I would say another just rule of thumb, again, and watch the Kanban session where I talk about how dangerous this rule of thumb is, but there's a rule of thumb that just basically says, visualize all your work on the board and set your whip limit to cutting it in half and cutting it in half again. So basically 25% right. of what you're trying to do today, that's a good whip limit to start with. Cutting it in half is probably good enough too. Principles here from limiting whip, the principles that we've talked about and tying back to those principles are limiting whip, obviously, and that's a big principle. Focusing on flow because we've reduced it and we're pulling now.
And we're not managing utilization now, we're managing whip limits.
Yes, exactly. Managing cues and whip limits, yep. Not utilization.
This is the point where you've made that switch, right?
Yep.
This is the point where you've decided, okay, it's more important for me to manage the flow of value, so I'm going to place whip limits, and I'm going to use whip limits to constrain the flow through my system. I'm not going to use utilization rates.
In fact, this was a question asked by one of the people in an early question, which was, how do I manage, for instance, this if I don't have a Gantt chart? If Gantt charts are for utilization, what is for flow? And the answer is a Kanban visualization.
With whip limits.
With whip limits, yep. Other things, embrace changing requirements, because we don't care how things flow up or down or are prioritized in our to-do columns. And the last one is sustainable development, and this is a big one. We want to be able to continually deliver value and not have people burned out. Here's an example of imposing some whip limits. In design, develop, and testing all have whip limits. What's interesting is that's done at the column level. You can also do whip limits at the across everything. Like we could limit new features to 5 and limit bugs to 2 or 3 or 4. You can limit things this way if you need to slice things up. You want to do sustainment efforts versus new product creation. You want to split them up. You can do that as well. But let's talk about these whip limits. Whip limits apply, and we covered it a little bit earlier, not just to what's in the working column. They apply to working and done.
Right.
So in design, we are limited to 3 items. If all 3 of those items were in the done column, I'm sorry, you've hit your whip limit, and now those designers should be looking at the developers and saying, looking right to the developments and saying, well now, what could we do to make your life easier? Yep. All right, that's whip limits. The next is managing flow. And in this particular case, we're going to need to identify bottlenecks and work to remove them, and then probably reduce our work in process limits to trigger some new bottlenecks. Right. This is the fun part. So the first 3 steps of Kanban, you're really just kind of getting a feel for getting things up on the board, getting your whip limits. This is where the rubber hits the road, and we really get to make the improvements and see those improvements made.
This is where you actually start doing Kanban.
Yeah.
Once you get here, once you get into the loop of managing flow, adjusting your whip limits, getting feedback, managing flow, adjusting your whip limits, once you get into that loop, that's when you're really starting to work a Kanban system.
Yep. And this is the exciting part.
Right.
I mean, I love the visualization phase because people go, woohoo! Look at how much stuff there is.
I've got an avatar!
Yeah, I've got an avatar. And it is fun. That part's really fun. It brings the team together. It's really, it's an enjoyable process. But when you get to here, this is where you've gone beyond, and the team is starting to say, ooh, what if we,
right,
X, Y, or Z? And they are starting to drive those changes themselves. Yep. This is the best part. There's some principles here. Focus on flow, manage your cues. Again, continuous value delivery and sustainable development are important here in managing flow.
Right.
As well.
So we're identifying a bottleneck in our Kanban board. In the beginning, this will always be the case where they're pretty obvious. You reduce your whip and you go, or you just throw it up on a board and you go, well,
that's obvious.
There's 75 things in the dev column. I think we've got an issue there, right? As you move along, they'll get more difficult to find, and you'll find ones that you'll find bottlenecks that seem to whip back and forth and do all sorts of very interesting things. But That's a couple months down the road. At first...
Yeah, and you'll find big things that come in and constipate your flow.
Yes.
They'll get plugged up in development, and then you'll have to kind of, you'll be working around them, and you'll go, wait, let's swarm it.
Right.
Get it through the system so we don't have to work on that large one again. We want to get back to our flow because we're focusing on flow. Yep. And when anything goes through that impedes that, you're going to want to get in there.
Yeah. You can start measuring all kinds of interesting metrics like how stale something is, how long has it been in that, it's a wonderful thing to measure instead of estimating. You actually just measure how long it's been in a column and then you know how big it is.
Exactly. Again, if you're in something like Team Foundation Server, you can pull all this data out and just kind of like lay it out.
Using Jeff's tabular model, it's even more beautiful, right?
Yeah,
it's all there for you. It just kind of falls right out.
Exactly. And we're talking about a tabular model. It's downloadable on
CodePlex,
I think, and on Visual Studio Gallery. Visual Studio Gallery, yeah. And just search for Jeff Levinson. Yeah. And he's got a great one there on Kanban. It pulls the Kanban columns from TFS into a tabular data model you can report on real easily. So in this case, if we look at the screen again, we see the dev queue as being our big one. First of all, there's a big giant queue. Why do we even have the queue thing? That totally violates our WIP limits. Let's axe it and go straight from done into development working, and our queue will then be in design done, and it'll have a WIP limit.
Well, we might not be quite ready for that.
We've
still got the efficiency expert who's saying that he needs to sign off on the design before it goes to development.
Yeah.
So instead, we're going to go ahead and mitigate that impact on our cycle time.
Okay.
And go ahead and push the button.
Yes.
And instead of, and we can't get rid of that guy.
Yeah.
We pay him $120,000 a year to sign off on those things, so we need to keep him around. It's very important. But instead, we'll just say, okay, fine. If you don't sign off on stuff and you get full, we'll just stop working until you sign off on the next thing.
Yeah, perfect. Throw a dev queue in there. Throw a WIP limit.
Yes.
It's a great way to start on that. Now we commit to continued improvement. We need to evaluate and evolve our existing processes. This part is part and parcel to the one before it. This is where we're just going through that cycle again, measuring, plan, do, check, act, observe, orient, decide, act. We're going through a process in which we're finding out what changes we should make. And every change in Kanban absolutely must be guaranteed to be successful, otherwise you should never do it, right? Am I right?
I almost fell out of my chair.
Of course not.
If let me put it this way. This is something I'm actually huge on in both the testing world and also in the process improvement world. If you don't have a 30 or 40% failure rate, you aren't trying enough things. You're just wasting everyone's time. If you have a whole test division and they never find any bugs, why are you paying them?
Right.
Right? Like stop paying them. They're not adding any value, right? It's the failure and the information that failure gives you that adds value to your system. And this is vitally important. If all of your little improvements to your Kanban board are making small incremental improvements, make a bigger change. Do something that's going to not work. In order to gain the information, well, that didn't work, now we can change course. If everything always works, you're doing something wrong.
I think this is a key element. Purchasing information is what you call it. And we won't dive into it in great depth, but I recommend you read some of your blog posts or take a look at that because, frankly, you've got some good insights on what it takes to purchase information. And one place we were at, they did this grand experiment and it failed. But what they learned from that grand experiment, I shouldn't say grand, it was a small, constrained experiment with measurable objectives, and we didn't come near to meeting the objectives, and we learned so much about why we didn't meet those objectives that was just hidden in the tribal knowledge before and that had been elevated to what should have been on a definition of done, was never there. Anyway, you learn a lot from failure. Don't negate it.
Yep.
So I was completely tongue-in-cheek when I said every improvement should always succeed, because it shouldn't.
There's a great tip on Don Reinertsen's blog, he doesn't call it a blog, it's just his website. So on his website, he has both long tips and short tips. And one of his long tips deals with this topic, and it is spot on about purchasing, using purchasing information and understanding the value of information, because just like everything, this is a U-shaped optimization. We don't want to be failing in purchasing information that doesn't deliver value comparable to the cost of the failure. We're probably not anywhere near needing to make that optimization yet until you get way more towards the pendulum swinging in the other direction to bring that up. But just he's got a great blog post on it that lays out a couple great scenarios.
Yeah, and then let me give you an example of failures that might resonate real clearly, which is estimation.
Right.
If you are spending so much time up front that your estimates are always exactly spot on, you're probably spending too much time on estimates. Not necessarily, but very, very likely, because estimates cost a lot of money to make. You must be extracting value from that. And there's two books I'm going to recommend that people read. One is called How to Measure Anything.
Oh, that's such a great book.
Oh, it's a fantastic book.
If you take my... I almost refuse to do point-in-time estimates in software anymore because of that book.
It's a brilliant book.
Once someone points out to you that it just doesn't make any sense to take this, to say that this will take 3 days when it will actually take, you're actually 80% confident it will take between 4 and 5 days, saying that it takes 3 days just sets expectations that shouldn't even be there.
It's clearly a fantastic book on that. And then another one is The Flaw of Averages. So those are two books that I'd recommend around this kind of idea of failure measurement. All right, but let's get back to that commit to continual improvement. What are the principles? The principles are we reflect regularly, we collaborate, simplicity, self-organization, fast feedback, kind of a lot of those key ones. And now when we come back into here...
We fired that guy.
Have a little bit cleaner board. We go from our new requirements into the development working. We've kind of integrated. We've found that we should integrate those business analysts right in with the developers to get through. Testing's still there on its own, but we're getting...
That's outsourced still.
It's outsourced still. We're getting there. And we're starting to make those continual improvements on our board. So we can kind of see as we go through what's happening to that. Let's wrap this up. Kanban, why it works. It focuses on the lean principles, a lot of the principles we've covered here. The agile principles generally fall out as a byproduct. They are part and parcel of lean in a lot of cases, but rather than explicitly called out, they just happen to appear. Again, the two different ways in which the communities evolved, at least in my interpretation, right. Agile came from what has worked. What's worked? Let's take those...
Experiential-based.
Experiential-based, exactly. Here's the experience we've had, and it worked. Lean comes from the theoretical sayings. It says this is why things work and why we should do it this way. They fall hand in hand, just two different ways to get to them, which is why those agile principles generally just come out of that as well. This next one is huge for me, and we won't beat it too much because it is part of a... It falls kind of outside the lean principles, but Kanban doesn't require giant enterprise buy-in. Frankly, I can't stand going into a senior executive's office and saying, so in the PBIs we were working on during the last Scrum sprint, the Scrum Master wasn't able. They don't have that terminology. That's not the right wording. And as you mentioned earlier, Andrew, a lot of them have been through some kind of lean training, some kind of Six Sigma training, some kind of theory of constraints understanding.
And they definitely have a financial background.
So you're talking their language. Let's just talk their language. Yeah. And the last one, Kanban works.
It does.
It just works. If you work it.
So that should probably be a caveat to this, is Kanban works if you work it. Mm-hmm. If you just put up your board and a bunch of cards and say we're doing Kanban, it will not work.
Yep.
You're not going to improve your process. If you work it and go through the loop, observe the whole loop, it works.
Exactly. And that's such a key piece for this. Let's culture flag this and let's wrap it. Kanban requires more than anything else, as it's a cultural change to really embrace some of these lean thinking things. It also helps drive that change.
Like we saw with the penny game. To go back to that example again, it's just When you just make that paradigm shift to flow, it just changes everything. It really does. It's a fundamental realigning of your organization.
It really is. It really is. So let's talk about some of the next steps where you should go. Definitely implementation. We've talked some of these things. Let's do a quick review. Economics over emotion. Yep. Value delivered over resource utilization. System over local optimization and decentralize that decision making. Some of the practices, we talked a few. There are a lot more. I'd love to see you pick up Don Reinertsen's book. Like to see you pick up David Anderson's Kanban book, Mary and Tom Poppendick's book. There's a lot of really good books out there. One of the ones you've seen pop up here is called Toyota Kata. That one completely blew my mind, so much so that I experienced some major changes in the way I thought about software development based on that book. Nothing to do with software.
I've also heard mentioned quite a bit the Toyota Manufacturing Way. Is that what it's called?
The Toyota Way.
The Toyota Way.
Yep.
Be careful when reading that book. You have to remember that manufacturing is different than product development.
Yes.
There are two different paradigms. You cannot apply the exact same ideas. The concepts align in a lot of ways, which is what makes it confusing, because a lot of the stuff aligns quite nicely, but there are some things that don't align quite nicely. And if you try to put that paradigm in place in a system with inherent variability, you're going to have pain.
Well, and the interesting thing is we're talking, again, principles versus practices.
Right.
The same principles underlie lean manufacturing as lean product development, but the practices are completely different.
Yeah.
So if you take the practices from one,
yeah,
and I think that's where a lot of the misunderstanding comes from. And then we talked about Kanban, kind of laid out Kanban. So, what do you go do? What do you do? How do you start?
The first one for me is to just open your eyes and look at your process through this lens. We talk a lot about taking a step above your current level and looking down on your current level to see where it fits in the bigger machine. You really have to be able to take a step back, look down, and apply the lean lens and start to understand where some of the bottlenecks are in your system. Obviously, Kanban is a great tool to help you gain that understanding.
Yeah. I think retrospect is the next one. I just keep coming back. Looking at your system, understanding your system, re-looking at your system, re-understanding your system. I know it sounds repetitive. It's one of the most exciting things because you're really focusing on making your system better.
Right.
And that reflection is critical. You want to be like Toyota, where you've got a million different good ideas to drive your system forward, even if you can only implement 100 of those, or 100,000.
And our marketplace isn't static. I mean, our marketplace, one of the most rapidly changing marketplaces in the history of the world, right? I mean, it's actually almost mind-blowing, because lots of times we view it in the short lens of, in the last 2 years, and we view it in that lens. But if you compare it to, you know, the way markets evolved in the 1900s, it's
mind-blowingly fast.
It's just mind-blowingly fast. In order to stay afloat, you have to constantly retrospect. Like the interplay that we talked about of the transaction cost for a deployment versus the optimal batch size, and how much changing that transaction cost per deployment can affect the optimal batch size, the interplay between those two things. Every time a new technology comes out, like release management, that can help you lower the transaction cost for a deployment, you have to go and revisit your optimal batch size, because it's just drastically changed.
Yeah.
And if you're not doing that on a continuous basis, you're going to get stale, and you won't ever be radically innovative.
Exactly. And even if you're not radically innovative, if you don't innovate, you just end up dying as an organization. So the next is introduce others. Reach out. Take some of these whiteboard examples. Play the penny game.
It takes 10 minutes, and it is amazingly powerful.
It is. And it gets people engaged. We play the penny game with CEOs, not just CIOs, not just technical people. We get people in that are playing the game, and it sounds ridiculous to have somebody at that senior of a level of organization standing there flipping pennies and having one hand tucked in their pants behind them, right? But it is amazing what that does and what conversations evolve from that. So definitely play that penny game.
It's even funnier when we get them to play the marshmallow game, though.
Yes, the marshmallow game's even better. That's for a whole other story. Lean is a mindset. Basically, it's a way of thinking. It's a way of approaching problems and finding those, I love the way you put this, economically optimal solutions, yep. Right? Or we're putting it inside of a lens, that economic lens, to see what can we do to deliver better along that measurement. If we pop back to the slides for a moment before we do our final wrap, I do want to kind of lay out, this is Andrew, this is myself, which you've seen a lot of our faces, but this kind of ties our email addresses and our Twitter tags to our faces. If you have more questions, please don't hesitate to reach out. Other places are fantastic to reach out to. MVA, definitely type in more comments. We'll be here for a bit with some more of the questions. But for what we can't answer, check these places out. Highly recommend looking out at a lot of different areas that you can see. Hey, look at that on the screen, what people see. This is awesome. I play right. Woo-hoo!
Picture in picture, hey.
I love it. sorry, I get all excited about that. We should have you talk pretty soon and see if you get up there. But seriously.
The picture looks better than real life, so we'll leave the picture.
Oh, there you are. Hello. Excellent. So here's the places you can reach
out
to us.
Wow, that's just slick right there.
That is so.
I would like to reach out. Sorry,
no,
kind of
please.
Just jumped in, but the production team here has been phenomenal.
Oh my goodness! Thank you.
I can't even describe how good this interaction has been. I know I was a little nervous coming in this morning. This is kind of the first time I've ever been in a format like this, but I can't thank them enough.
Absolutely, just wonderful people here, and giving us just kind of. Really laying out the support we've needed and everything. Thanks to our assistants as right. we went up, but as well coming back to Barry and just his wonderful interaction. So any more questions, hit this. And if not, what we'd like to do is just kind of wrap on some of those final ideas. Any last minute thoughts?
Evangelize. If you agree with what we're saying, go learn more, but don't keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Software is not created in a vacuum anymore. The days where one guy in his basement they're gone. Enterprises need multiple people, and they need those people to work together. Spread the message.
Absolutely.
We need more people with a more realistic view of how to deliver software, and we need them to talk to each other.
And to kind of extend that, I'm going to say I agree, and then I want you to go forward and take this up the chain of wherever you're at.
Right.
Now that you take some of this vocabulary and see what your management can do with it, you'd be surprised at how receptive management tends to be when you're talking their language and you're showing them what can be possible rather than just kind of saying, well, this has worked other places. And that's important, but you need to kind of prove it out. And I think this can hopefully help give you a little bit of those foundations. All right. Well, I'd like to thank everyone for attending. There's a poll out there, and I'm going to highly encourage you to do that poll if you would. That's how the Microsoft Virtual Academy knows to continue on with the ALM Wednesdays or stop the ALM Wednesdays.
Right. When we talk about persist or pivot decisions, this poll is it, right? This is one of our ways to get a fast feedback loop and rearrange our content to provide you with the value that you expect.
Exactly. And if this is going to persist, then you'll have more ALM Wednesdays. That's a nice thing to ask for. Throw some topics in there that you might be interested in, comments. And we definitely want to thank you for attending, and we look forward to seeing you next week when we'll be talking about enterprise agility and how to take some of these lean ideas and push them up through the entire enterprise. Thank you very much for coming.